Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. Your hosts are Dr. On, clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. I'm going to turn this over to you, Xander, so you can introduce our guest.
Thank you, On. It's going to be a great episode. We're all great. This is going to be great, too. So our guest today is Regan Swanson. Regan is the executive director of The Archives, which is one of the largest independent, I'm going to spell this out, 2SLGBTQIA+ archives in the world, which has a mandate to safeguard community history. Welcome to the show, Regan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Can we do a little bit of work talking about what all those letters, that number, and that symbol represent? Let's just get that over with so that people understand when we're talking about the archives.
Sure. So one of the things that is become more commonplace, especially in Canada, is to represent the Indigenous community first and foremost when we talk about the initialism. So one of the descriptors that is used commonly is Two-Spirit. And so to acknowledge colonialism and the impacts of white supremacy and everything that comes with it, we've, along with many others, including the government of Canada even, put the Two-Spirit at the beginning. And that's in recognition of the impact and the Indigenous queer community.
And then, just in case we have listeners from all over the world, could you continue on with LGBTQ, the I, the A, the symbol at the end?
Yeah, sure. So we do the LGBT, which of course tends to be the most commonplace. We use the Q for queer, I is often for intersex, and A is for asexual, and plus is for everybody else, because the acronym can get, of course, a little unwieldy. We have a lot of folks from the older generations that aren't keen to be called queer. So I know that a lot of archives like Australia and Britain have really moved to just being Australia's queer archive, but we heard that wasn't what our membership and our donors wanted. So we kept the initialism, and you know, that might change over time. We've had a couple of different names, but for now, that's what we're going with.
Yeah, I think I've seen in Australia in particular, the use of sex and gender minorities.
Yes, I've seen that as well. Yes.
I was remembering in the 1990s, the Q was for questioning.
Yeah.
I was on a panel a couple of years ago with some other social workers, and the interviewer asked us what the A stood for. And we all had different answers because we're all from different generations. And I had no idea that it was now for asexual. I guess we could just put everybody on there, right? I mean, there's so many sexualities. So that's interesting. What happened to allies? And then questioning went away. Sometimes I see a double Q, but I am one of those people. I don't like to be referred to as queer. I don't use that terminology. I don't subscribe to queer politics. Yeah, I think it's just helpful for people to hear what that all means. And for individuals who are not familiar with what the LGBT means, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans. That can be transgender, transsexual. There's a lot of different ways, but oftentimes it's just shortened to trans. And On and I are trans men, so we're familiar with the trans part of the community. I was a lesbian. I've spent 25 years in lesbian community, so I'm familiar with that community to that degree. Yes. Okay, good. So now we've got that out of the way. What I'd really love to hear from you, Regan, is how you got into the work of archiving. What is archiving, and how you specifically found yourself at the archives? And the letters are different. It's not A-R-C-H-I-V-E-S. It's not archives like you would think. So is there a reason for that? Is it an acronym for something?
We like to say it's archives with a Q. And so it's a nod to the queerness of it all. But yeah, we found ourselves in a situation where we needed a name, and we've had many of them over the years. When I first started with the organization, we were the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives. Before that, we were the Canadian Gay Archives. And in 1973, we were the Canadian Gay Liberation Movement Archives. So yeah, we're archives with a Q now. I started with a love of history, and I was, for better or for worse, raised by a teacher who every time we went on vacation would make us do research about where we were going before we went, which, you know, I could imagine many 12-year-olds not being keen to do that, but we enjoyed it. And when it came to my undergrad, I found myself in the history department pretty quickly. And I thought I was going to be a librarian. I thought I wanted to work with books. I loved books so much. And it wasn't until I was finishing my history degree and kind of thinking about what came next that I realized that archives might be a possibility. And that's because two professors came in from the archives department and really did quite the sales pitch. They were talking about how exciting it was to work with historical documents, about how important it was for communities to see them reflected in their history. And I took the bait. I took the bait and I started going and volunteering at a local archive that really was a community archive. So community archives are spaces where a very particular community collects their own history. So it's about telling your own story. And to me, that was so powerful. It was so interesting to hear how people talked about themselves. And it wasn't the stories that you would hear in the history books, because those aren't written by community. Those are written about communities for the most part. So to see like these file folders filled with community voices, I fell in love. I fell in love with being able to hear communities talk about themselves. And so when I went to do my master's in archiving, I came to Toronto and I went to the iSchool, which is where they do archives and records management. And I ended up at the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives trying to convince them to let me do an internship. And it worked. I got the internship. And at the time, there was one staff member and there was 50 volunteers that kept the place going. And I really loved it there. It was so nice to be in community. It was so nice to work with collections from all across the world, really, but mostly from Canada. And so later on, when the opportunity came to apply for a job at the archives, after working with communities all over, well, middle of the country in the east of Canada, and I jumped at the opportunity to come back and work with queer and trans communities.
Very cool.
All in all, how long have you been at it?
Oh, goodness. 18 years? 19 years? 19 years working as a student, doing summer placements while I was trying to study. I finished my PhD in archives. So I've been working and doing the academic side at the same time. And so, yeah, it's been 19 years of working in libraries and archives.
So you're an expert.
I have experience, yes.
That's interesting. Yeah. The idea of having expertise, that might be not a comfortable thing to embrace, huh? But it's like a PhD is a signifier of that in some ways. You know, I didn't know that there was a separate degree in archiving. I thought it might be a type of like a track in library science or something. So what's the difference between doing a master's in library science and a master's in archiving? What's the difference between somebody who works in a library that's doing reference librarian things and somebody who's archiving? What's the difference there?
So librarians usually work with published material. So books that have been published, material that is available for people to circulate. So like most public libraries will have books that you take out. And of course, there's reference libraries where you have to go and you're not allowed to take the books out. Usually they're really fancy books and cost a lot of money. But archives are about primary source material. So that's the material that's created by somebody. So we're talking about diaries, we're talking about photographs, scrapbooks, lots of letters. We're talking about the material that historians dig into to write those books. So it's a lot of uncovering. I don't know. That's not quite the right word that I want to use, because people tend to say, I discovered it in the archive, as if someone had placed it in a folder in a box on the shelf already. But yeah, it's a lot of digging through people's boxes and looking for the story of their life and using that and organizing and again, ready for researchers for when the people want to write those books that the librarians will circulate and share, that the historians and the writers and the artists, they have something to work with.
Interestingly enough, I listened to a podcast this morning live, and the person that was being interviewed, her name was Colleen, I believe it's Shogan. She was the archivist of the United States. So it's an appointed position by the president and then confirmed by our Senate. And it was very interesting listening to her talk about what that meant. I think she had worked at maybe the Library of Congress also, and fascinating. You were talking a little bit about the, like, capturing stories. Does that include the oral histories? Because I know here in the United States, we have there's several small, but we have a national effort called Outwards, which is an oral history project, and where they conduct interviews and then they keep the audio and the visual of those, and then have a written transcript and then a description, but then also people send in photographs. They've been making an effort to interview people that are of a certain age. Let's just say I got interviewed because I'm of a certain age, and so to collect those things. But there are smaller ones that are regional. Would that be something also that an archivist would be interested in, would be the oral histories?
Yes, we do a lot of oral history projects. We've worked with and had meetings with Outwards as well. So we're familiar with some of the American groups. And actually, we met with the folks in the UK at Bishopsgate as well. So we're lucky to have lots of partners in lots of places around the world. The oral histories are usually the things that people love to listen to because it's like sitting down and hearing it from the person directly. It's a little bit different than reading a diary. The diary feels a little bit more salacious, I would say. But being able to sit down with someone and to hear them talk, it's kind of like you're getting to peek into conversation that someone's having. And being able to listen in. I like that. I like being able to listen in. I had a professor who said that people become archivists so that they can read other people's mail. I think it's also that they can listen to other people's conversations as well.
So I have a question for you about that cross-referencing where you're working with other groups across the U.S. What makes that happen?
Usually it's personal connections, because the organizations that we all work for have very little money. And the money that used to be there with grants isn't there. We don't have quite the same situation as the folks in America, but most of the archive funding has been cut. A large portion of the women and gender equality budget has been cut. So the grants that we do have are minimal. They're usually project-based. So we rely on community connections to keep us together. Knowing about someone's work, having a researcher that's been to one place and another and introduced us. And every once in a while, traveling and being at conferences or events together. We're not traveling to the United States right now, but I got to go to Portugal. And while I was in Portugal, I got to meet people from the Brazil Queer Archives. And so keeping those personal connections and relying on community to support each other, that's really been super important, because it's not like we have formal networks. We keep trying, but you know, there's a lot of turnover when you can't have steady streams of income coming in.
Is there an international body of archivists, and they have maybe, I'll just abbreviate LGBT because we're talking internationally, but specialization that people can be a member of, or you can be a member of archives and get together that way? Or is it not as formal?
There's been a conference that's usually been in Europe, and it was every 2 years. I think the last one was in 2019. But again, it tends to be people working off the side of their desks. There's one or two queer or trans collections in a country, and then there's a few smaller collections that are held by universities or, say, a government archive. But it's really hard to organize when we have so many frontline services that are taking up our time, when we're spending a lot of time fighting for housing and for rights to any particular rights around being able to express gender or sexuality. Organizing things like a history conference sometimes can take a back seat, especially when there's political upheaval. I would like to think that there's going to be more international conferences again. We're having a Canadian one next week, which would be mid-May. In Halifax, Nova Scotia, so on the East Coast. We're trying to see if we can keep the Canadian one going every 2 years. But yeah, it's tricky because we applied for grants to host the conference in Canada, and every single one of them was turned down. And it was only queer and trans community organizations that really stood up and pitched in some money to help us book space. And that's really community having to rely on each other to be able to make those connections and make that happen.
I guess I was under a false sense of understanding of Canada. I'm hearing something that doesn't make sense to me. And it sounds like you're describing other places other than Canada that there would be a lack of funding from the government. I guess I was under the impression that there were different levels of awareness and sensitivities to these topics in Canada, at least as in the way that it gets compared to the United States. It made it sound like we were the baddies and you were the goodies. So it's one of those, I think I'm surprised to hear this, that there is a struggle for resources there.
Yeah, and we have provinces the same way the United States has states. And there's some provinces where trans rights, especially for youth, have been completely obliterated. And that doesn't really fit with the overall picture I know a lot of people have of Canada, but it's the reality for many trans youth in Canada. They are worried about which provincial government, which controls healthcare, will be in place, because even if the federal government leans centrist, or, well, many people would call what we have right now very centrist or right-leaning, but compared to the United States, we're basically communist. And so we've got our own struggles. It's not to say that there isn't any funding. It's just not as much as needs to exist. And most organizations still struggle to meet the demands of the community.
Sure. So what's happening in, say, Alberta, it impacts archives because it's taking up people's time, energy, resources to deal with that, fight that. Is that what might be happening? That there's all these things going on? I don't think that something like an archives would be frivolous or something extra, right? Like, the ability to document history is super important. So, but maybe that's how people might see it. There's more important things to deal with. You think that's what's going on?
Yeah, I think part of it is that it's really easy for most people to identify most frontline services: housing, healthcare, HIV and AIDS prevention. And then you have the other camp of the arts, and the arts are here to express our joy and our pain and like to be a vehicle for that. But where does heritage fit in? Because there's definitely a mental health component to being able to see yourself represented in museums and libraries, but we don't fit cleanly into that slot. So it puts us in a weird spot where you're trying to advocate for yourself, but at the same time, you totally understand that, yeah, people want to be supporting frontline services that are around making sure trans youth are housed. Never going to argue with that. But it is important to recognize the impact that being able to see yourself represented in a community, especially when you're not born into it, to know that it's there. And I think that archives and libraries and museums are part of that space. And some of it is online and some of it is physical. And if you've never seen yourself in a museum, if you've never seen yourself in a book before, it could be easy, especially before the internet, to believe that you were the only one. And so I think that there needs to be a shift to understanding that museums, libraries, and archives, heritage organizations, they play just an important role, because in 20 years, how are we going to remember this time? Because the way that we remember now is not the same way that the people in the future are going to think about it. We need to documenting what we're doing, because it's also for the next generation of youth that are going to come out and wonder, what was it like before? And am I the only person that's ever been like this? I know that it's different for even the youth that we work with. Sometimes we've got middle schoolers and high schoolers that come into our organization and do projects with us, and their experience is nothing like mine. And it's nothing like the people of my parents' generation. And it's nothing like the generation before that either. So I think that library and archives and museums, they've got a place, and it's a little awkward shaped.
So we have the arts that represent genres, and there's music that does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought about joining forces with those groups?
Oh yeah, we do. Lots of artists come through our space. They select photos for their documentaries. They do research on time periods, on what bars were like. They learn about hanky codes. They come in and they look at t-shirts and fashion from different time periods for when they make their movies. There's other people that have written music and produced abstract film based on the feeling of coming into the archives and hoping to see something particular and finding out that it was never recorded. The silences are just as important. It documents what was possible to say, what wasn't, how possible possible it was to write a book about something. And so we've worked with those groups, and we just, with the National Film Board of Canada, even last year, we produced a film. Well, they produced the film called Parade. We produced a whole lot of photographs and research for them, for them to be able to tell the story. And it's interesting because people come in with an idea of, you know, I'm really looking for this. And sometimes it's not there at all. And that can be really heartbreaking, but sometimes it is there. And then that's so exciting. And if it's not there, maybe it's an opportunity to look for where it could possibly be. Maybe it still exists. Maybe it's out there in someone's basement. We just need to find it. Who was there? And you start having those conversations. Who was around? But yeah, there's a lot of stories that are lost, and we're not going to hear them. And so part of what we do is try to make sure that the next generations don't have as many lost stories.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Regan Swanson, who is the executive director of the Archives, spelt with a Q, ARQUIVES, one of the largest independent 2SLGBTQIA+ archives in the world. She has a mandate to safeguard that history. Let's take a break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg. Let's get back to the show.
What about merging funding? Do you already do that as a cohesive group?
We try to do that sometimes, and some grants now allow for a certain amount of research money to be able to just be handed over and we can help them with research. But I think the less money that exists in the pot, the more documentation you need to provide to be able to get it. And so, you know, the flexibility isn't always there. We work a lot with universities now. In Canada, we call it SHRC funding, so Social Studies and Humanities Research Council. They do a lot of grants and various projects. So we're able to collaborate with professors from York University, University of Toronto. One of the big ones is Elspeth Brown's project, the Digital Collaboratory. So doing oral history interviews. And, you know, some of them are around bigger concepts, like thinking through the museum. How do we queer a museum? How do we make sure that trans voices are represented? How do we make sure Indigenous voices are represented? And how do we not silo each other so that the queer or trans Indigenous person has to pick one space or another? How can we see ourselves represented throughout the space? I think a lot of those projects are really important. However, it doesn't necessarily pay the rent or keep the lights on. You know, they're amazing projects to be a part of, and it's really great to work with the youth and to the students that are involved, but we still need to pay our staff and make sure that we've got enough file folders and pencils and all that jazz.
Well, you're speaking to two people who have done frontline service work. right? As a nurse, I'm a social worker. So we clearly understand that it can get to a point sometimes where it is maybe considered more important or more valuable. And I think it is important and valuable, but to negate or dismiss something like libraries, museums, and archives as being, I don't know, I would imagine people would think that's just what rich people care about, or, you know what I mean? Who goes to the museums, right? I think there's probably class issues around that, but that's part of the total way of looking at a person holistically, right? That's about whole health, right? And being exposed to all kinds of things that are beautiful, whether you're looking at things or listening to things or reading things, learning about things, that's really helpful. And I think you said it correctly about how when you can see yourself, right? For some people, I mean, I didn't have to see people. I was okay, right? That's not my personality. But for people who need that, it's going to be a part of their own feeling better, right? It's their own maybe self-worth, their self-esteem. It's not something that's outside or external, but I would imagine trying to make that claim might be met with position. You're right, because it's not that bottom rung of the Maslow's hierarchy. You know, it's not about housing and food and clothing and safety, security, but it's chronicling a people and peoples and their experience. And you're right, it's going to be really helpful for people to see that. I know that was helpful for me. Not that I needed to see myself, but I loved learning about history. Right. Yeah. I thought it was really cool to learn about the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis in the States and the first gay organization that was officially recognized as a business in the United States in Chicago in like the early 1900s, so that we can say, OK, we didn't have equal access legally to things, but people existed and they were out and they were doing things and they were publishing magazines and they were doing newsletters and they were having gatherings and people chronicled all of those things. And then they can be made available. And then you can see it. I remember the last time, it was probably about a decade ago, I saw something that it was just a book full of pictures with no names, right? Because everybody was very secretive. It was a cross-dresser network. And they got together in people's homes and went on vacations together and did all these great things. And so it was just picture after picture of them at the beach, in the restaurant, the dance pavilion, whatever they were doing, they were taking their own pictures. And I think most of them had passed and somebody found these pictures and then put them in a book, right? So that people could see. Some people were actually not hiding in shame, right? That people were out living their lives and they actually had wives with them. And right, it was like, for some people, that can be very liberating and eye-opening. And that is part of whole health, right?
Yeah. And I think you have to look at what people think of when they think of libraries and archives and museums, because there is the class element that you talked about. But I think for most people, they think of government records. They think of one of the big reasons archives exist is to uphold democracy, which is why they tend to be attacked when fascist and regimes come in, because that's where the document, that's where the dirty secrets are hidden for governments. But when you think about where do trans and queer and bi youth, where do they exist within the archive? And if you think about government records, they exist in criminal records. And that's the number one spot you're going to find them. You're going to see them in surveillance records. You're going to find arrest records. And for a lot of archives that people have access to, that's the only thing they're going to find. And so if you think about archives as being that kind of space, then yeah, I totally understand why someone might not feel like this would be somewhere to invest their time and energy. But in the 1960s, as part of the cultural kind of revolution that was going on, it really became a primary focus through labor activism, Black activism, all these different groups, women's rights, to tell the own stories. And that's where community archives come in. And that's where it comes down to community doing what it has to support each other. And if that means collecting our own histories and making them accessible, that's what we have to do, because the government sure wasn't doing it before. And we see more interest now in documents and letters and artifacts being collected by museums, national museums and provincial museums, but they still talk about adding to the collection to make it more fulsome, but they don't talk about why they need to add material to the collection now to make it more fulsome. They don't say we never collected this because we didn't believe in queer rights and trans rights. We didn't believe an LGBT experience being documented as part of the Canadian experience, a part of the American experience. So I think that if we have to think about the way that we're talking about archives, and are we talking about a community organization that their board is queer or trans, that it's gay folk and bi folk and asexuals and questioning, and are they on the staff? Are they the donors? Are they donating their material? And, you know, if the answers are yes, if that's the kind of organization that it is, then I think it's important that we remember that there's plenty of material that exists. It's just not necessarily in the archive that's going to be most available to you. And sometimes you do have to dig a little.
Now, the archives are in Toronto. Are they open to the public, or can people come in? Do you have open hours?
Yeah, so we take researchers by appointment because we have a very small space, so it tends to fill up. But we have our entire collection pretty much searchable online, so people can type in terms and keywords and look. And then because we're a national organization, or try to be, we also have a bunch of digital exhibits that we have made available. So you can sit down and listen to those oral histories that we talked about earlier and listen to people talk about their experience of X, Y, or Z. And yeah, so it's a little bit of being able to browse that way. Especially if you can't come into Toronto. We do lots of reference services by email. So if people have questions about a certain topic, they can email in and we can try to find answers for them.
I'm assuming it's digitized. It's not like microfiche. Microfilm. I remember doing that in college.
Oh, there's still a lot of libraries that I've done research at where you have to still use those machines and they still make me dizzy no matter what. But yeah, we digitize a lot of material. Not everything is digitized because it's just terribly expensive. But we do our best to try to make sure that people have access to material, especially if it's something that can't be found anywhere else.
You mentioned donors. Do you have members? Can people become a member of the archives?
Yeah, we've got three different ways that people can become members because we reflect different values. So it's not just about being a monetary donor. Like, there's lots of people that volunteer their time, and so they can be donors. There's other people that donate material to the collection, and that's another way to become a donor. So we don't prioritize one over the other. We want it to be an inclusive space. So if you don't have money to donate, then some people can donate their time. Some people can donate a copy of the zine that they made. There's different ways to become a member and to be able to do things like vote on our board of directors. And that helps guide the way that the organization is going to change and flow over the years.
I think you mentioned when we first started talking that you started out the archives as you were a student. So you were doing an internship. And at the time there was one staff person.
Yep.
How many staff are there now?
There are 11 staff members now.
Wow.
And just shy of 100 volunteers.
Wow. Okay. It's grown quite a lot.
Yeah. So we're doubled in size volunteer-wise. And I have to double check what it is now. But right before COVID lockdowns, because Toronto was very affected by lockdowns, for every 1 hour that a staff person put in, 4 hours were put in by volunteers. So we're still very supported in the day-to-day running of the organization by volunteers. And some volunteers have been with us for 49 years. Other volunteers have been with us for 6 months since they turned 18, and they're just tiny little baby in comparison to some of the old timers. But we're very lucky. We have a waiting list of people who want to be engaged with history. And that part feels really great because I've worked with a lot of libraries and archives and museums, and that's not always the case. But there's a really strong interest into us LGBTQIA+ folks really wanting to be involved and wanting to be engaged. And whatever it is, for some people, it's working with the archival material. For other people, it's making social media posts. Some people literally just come and do gardening in our front lawn. And it's really just what you can contribute as a person. They want to be able to help. And it's really amazing to see everybody come together.
What about philanthropists? Do you have big success with philanthropists or contributors in many ways, not just financially?
We try. I think that archives have always and probably will continue to be fairly low-key and a little bit less visible. And so trying to make people excited about archives is a lot of what we do. Trying to make people excited about the idea of donating time or money to a project that you might not see the outcome for like 30 years. That's a harder sell. It's a harder sell to say that in 30 years, this is going to change somebody's life. But we're still working on it. And I think that the more accessible that we can make the collections, and the internet has definitely assisted with that, the more that we can make the collections available, the more that people can see themselves reflected. I think that that's where we've got our website presence and our online presence more generally. The number of people visiting our website jumped by 50% last year, 50% increase. And that was mostly due to various projects that we were doing, the workshops that we were doing with younger folk, the little things were starting to add up. And so, yeah, we're really excited about what can come next as we get people more and more excited, because history happens every day. And so trying to get rid of the idea of the dust, because we're way more interesting than the dust. We got way cooler stuff than the dust that would imply.
Yeah, it surprises me because I can't pull up a well-known Canadian at the moment, but we have the Bill Gates and a number of people who have a keen interest in certain subject matters, and they contribute to these foundations and organizations, schools, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just surprises me that no one would have, not no one, but that there's limited interest expressed by philanthropists in that arena. It is, it's history.
It is history. And we're lucky there's a few people, one of them, Martha McCain, for example, super interested in education and paid for us to develop primary source guides for history and social studies teachers in high schools. So we do get support from community members that like help make those projects possible, because we applied for grants for that for ages and we're not successful. And so you do have to rely on those community members that have the means to support those types of projects, because it's tricky. Funding is tricky.
In the United States, we have a handful of trans women in particular that are millionaires, multimillionaires, and billionaires. And I sometimes wonder why I don't see their name more prominently as providing funding to things. And so it's always a bit of a head scratch. But I was thinking about, historically speaking, Reed Erickson, who was here in the United States, Dr. DeVore out in the University of Victoria, has written a lot about Reed Erickson. He contributed a lot of funding to the One Archives.
Yes.
Which I believe when I was a teenager was in Los Angeles. So I'm thinking it's still probably in Los Angeles.
It's at the university now. It's the largest one in the world.
Right. Here is an individual with a lot of money. They also created the Erickson Education Foundation, which then became Janus. And it's gone through multiple evolutions, but that was a particular repository, right, for sex education. And I know that they're out there, right? But where do they put their emphasis? That's, for some, it's on science, right? The owner of Sirius XM satellite radio, Martine Rothblatt, is a trans woman, right? That's a lot of money, I'm sure, in that business. But I think a lot of their money goes into science, a particular health science oriented. I forget the name of the family, the governor of Illinois. It's that family. They own, is it the Hilton or the, might be the Hiltons. I forget their names, but one of them is a trans woman. But she was in the military for many, many years, and she gives a lot of money to things that are military, trans and military specific. So I think they kind of have their causes. So we just we have to find more very generous members of the community who have a high value for retaining history. Right? Yeah. That's the...
Who love the books.
Sort of the intersection there.
We are going to take our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Reagan Swanson. We're always thankful to play our sponsors' commercials. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach. Here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg, and our guest is Regan Swanson. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, who are interested in reading other people's mail. I think that if people had an idea of some of the things that they could learn, I think that that might help. There's some things that we keep restricted and will be restricted for a while for everyone's privacy and safety and things like that. But yeah, you learn a lot by reading someone's diary, I have to say.
Well, and how many years has the archives been around? It's been through many names and iterations. It was over 40-something years, right?
Yeah, we're at 53 years now. 53. So we were founded in 73. Mm-hmm. The mandate stayed the same. We collect anything in any medium. So we've got a library collection, artifact collection, and then the archives and reference material. It's extensive, yeah. But that's what happens after 53 years of taking in material.
I would imagine that the seed money provided by people like Reed Erickson for the One Archives, maybe they invested it. And so they still have money today, right? Because of all that decades of compounding. And I wonder, that might be good for people to hear now. If you want to do something now, invest in it now, right? Yeah. Because that money will grow and grow and grow and grow. It's like putting $5,000 in your kid's bank account when they're born. By the time they're in their 60s, they're going to have millions of dollars, even if they never touch it again. That's just how compounding works. We need to invest, right? You talked about it. We can invest time. We can invest materials. We can invest money. But investing in that money in particular, in not just the organization, but the organization's ability to invest it in some way so they can build and build and build and into perpetuity. I would imagine that small nonprofits or community-based organizations aren't necessarily thinking about putting donor dollars in index funds.
No, it gets tricky because we had a very generous donor who left money for us in his will. But because we've got that money in reserves, we're not eligible for grants anymore. So that money's put aside. We really want a new building. Toronto real estate is notoriously bad. So it's going to cost us a lot of money. We need that money for when we need a new building. But yeah, I've been turned down for grants because I've got investments. And even though we've put it aside for our future growth and for the health of the organization, the funders don't really care. They kind of say, well, you've had it for a really long time. And yeah, because it's really hard to raise money to buy a building in downtown Toronto. So yeah. It's tricky.
They want you to be scrappy.
They want us to be scrappy. They want us to need the money because then they can decide that you're going to use the money for this project because this is what we're willing to spend money on. And that's the tricky part. I think that there's lots of organizations that have become part of universities or government. And I think that we're independent still because that's what the membership has wanted and that staff have wanted. We would, at the same time, we'd love to have more financial stability. But at the same time, if I want to digitize some lesbian porn that came to us that has been hiding in someone's basement and hasn't been seen in 30 years, like I can do that. I can do that and not worry about reporting to someone about trying to justify what we think is important, because we know that that needed to be done. So there's pros and cons to that independence. And we shared space with AIDS Committee of Toronto. We shared space with the Body Politic publication. We shared space with tons of different organizations over the years. But we've been able to make decisions like that, that mean that we can put community material first. We can decide what we keep. We can decide how we're going to provide access. We're going to decide to make an exhibit on XY topic because we know that nobody would do a topic on topic Z if it was at a government level. So the flexibility that independence gives us around being able to represent the community more fulsomely, I think, is the trade-off. I don't think any of us that really work with the archives right now would want to trade that independence for a little bit more financial security, because we've seen what happens when governments try to interfere with archives and libraries and museums. We can see it. It's happening everywhere. And it's happened like that for generations and generations. There's a reason that they go for the libraries, that they burn the books, because that's how we see each other. That's how we see each other's histories and our stories are represented. Being able to control our own narrative, being able to control our own history about who gets to come in and be able to see material, there's a value to that that is more than just monetary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah. Well, I've really enjoyed just learning more about you, learning more about the archives. Where can people find more information about the archives online?
So people can find us at arquives.ca. And from there, you can find our collections database, which is just like searching your public library. You can do that search. And you can also find our digital exhibitions online as well from our main site. And that will bring you to more than 30 different little exhibits that have been done about a whole range of topics, exploring some of the artifacts that we have, some of the books, oral histories, videos, you name it. So there's enough to keep you busy for many, many months. We do workshops, zine making workshops, button making workshops. We pull out a duplicate material from the collection so you can make duplicate buttons of material from buttons from the 1960s or the 1990s. We do walking tours and tours of the collection. We do film screenings and all kinds of talks and presentations kind of all over the place. So there's going to be workshops about getting into digitization of materials. And lots coming up. We do exhibits as well. So we've got a couple of exhibits on the burner for the next couple of months. Those are very exciting.
Well, Reagan, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us about archives and just all the different information about why it's necessary, how it's important, and what it takes to keep history alive. So thank you for the work that you're doing, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We've reached the end of the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Sandra Keg. You were listening to our guest, Reagan Swanson. We hope that you enjoyed the show. Until next time, thank you for listening.